Welcome to the Mushrooms Apprentice. I am going to start this episode with a quote by H.L. Mencken from the American Mercury from April 1924. And he wrote, quote, "That erroneous assumption is to the effect that the aim of public education is to fill the young of the species with knowledge and awaken their intelligence. Nothing could be further from the truth. The aim of public education is not to spread enlightenment at all. It is simply to reduce as many individuals as possible to the same safe level, to breed and train a standardized citizenry, to put down dissent and originality. That is its aim in the United States, whatever the pretensions of politicians, pedagogues, and other such mountebanks, and that is the aim everywhere else." End quote. Well, today we call that standardized schooling, which is essentially a factory system that teaches information to be memorized, but it doesn't teach how to actually comprehend and reason and then clearly express from a place of understanding. School teaches children what to think, not how to think. State-run schooling is designed to take children as young as possible away from the influences of their family, to be placed in an institutional setting where the child is trained to look to his teacher, his peers, and the state for authority, thereby undermining the authority of the child's family in order to accomplish the socialist goals of unwavering obedience to the state. Any ability to think in a logical manner is replaced by programmed thinking that contains politically correct ideologies and strict adherence to one's programming. State schooling stifles the child's natural affinity for learning and instead indoctrinates and programs the child to be an unquestioning member of a herd rather than a critically thinking individual. This is very clearly illustrated by the Random House Dictionary definition of the word bureaucrat, which is defined as, quote, "an individual who works by fixed routine without exercising intelligent judgment," end quote. Well, we've all been trained to abdicate our minds to the authority of others, to our great detriment, and ultimately to the dehumanization of people. In her 18-page essay, The Lost Tools of Learning, written in 1948, Dorothy Sayer wrote, quote, "Is not the great defect of our education today, a defect traceable through all the disquieting symptoms of trouble that I have mentioned, that although we succeed in teaching our pupils subjects, we fail lamentably on the whole in teaching them how to think? They learn everything except the art of learning. It is as though we have taught a child mechanically and by rule of thumb to play the harmonious blacksmith upon the piano, but had never taught him the scale or how to read music, so that having memorized the harmonious blacksmith, he still had not the faintest notion how to proceed from that to tackle the last rose of summer." End quote. So in this episode, I'm going to discuss a method of learning that has been part of a Western classical education from antiquity through the centuries, yet none of us have been given this true education because it's not included in public and most private schools and colleges. The system is called the trivium, which is Latin for where three roads meet. This is the foundation for learning everything. It's the threefold language arts that lead to knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. This is a scientific method that serves as the preparation for learning, where we take what our five senses, hearing, sight, touch, taste, and smell, experience in the outside world of reality, and categorize that into a system that reveals patterns that we qualify through language. This system was used by the Greeks, the Romans, and the Hebrews, and later by priestly scholars in the Middle Ages who taught the trivium to the children of the wealthy. Upon mastering this threefold system, one possesses the ability to gain knowledge and understanding of any chosen subject and can move on to the more abstract numerical system called the quadrivium. The trivium is a natural system, and it's said to be rooted within our creative nature. So the three language arts of the trivium are grammar, which is the study of words and linguistic symbols used to describe and qualify what our five sense experience is in reality. It's the facts of the subject, the who, what, where, and when, that give us a body of knowledge or information. Next comes logic, which is the art of thinking, where we learn skills in reasoning to critically analyze and understand the information grammar provides us and organize that information in a cohesive, non-contradictory system. This is done through Aristotelian logic, where all contradictions, inconsistencies in the grammar are identified and eliminated. Logic gives us a level of mastery in statements, arguments, and fallacies, whereby we're able to discern truth from untruth, which gives us understanding. With a mastery of logic, we can identify and correct our own mistakes in thinking and the mistakes of others. We're all fallible, and we can fall into misinterpretation, bias, and emotion, which clouds our ability to access truth. We want our thinking to be aligned with reality, unburdened by contradiction. The third in the language arts system is rhetoric. And this is the art of expression, where we develop creative and persuasive speech with the learned grasp of vocabulary we've attained via grammar and logic. Rhetoric enables us to effectively and wisely speak on a subject and put into practice what we've learned. This represents wisdom. So in computer terms, grammar is the input, logic is the processing, and rhetoric is the output. Put another way, the outside world of reality is the stimulus, which is the input and thought, followed by thinking, which is processing, logic, understanding, and motion, and concluding with response, which is output, wisdom, and action. Once we learn the system, we will have the ability to learn anything we set our minds to. The trivium is then followed by the quadrivium, which consists of four specialized subjects known as arts or sciences. This is also called the humanities. They are arithmetic, music, geometry, and astronomy. Pythagoras said that these four subjects are related to each other mathematically, where the language arts of the trivium are qualifying our reality. The four subjects of the quadrivium are quantifying reality. So arithmetic is number in order. Music is number in sound and time. Geometry is number in shape. And astronomy is number in space and time. These seven subjects are called the liberal arts because they liberate the mind and they prepare you for freedom. In ancient times, only free men were allowed to learn this system, while the common people were not. And sadly, this hasn't changed much today, as the general population is not taught the trivium in school, because schooling is designed to prepare the masses ultimately for servitude, which ultimately protects the wealthy elite from any kind of competition. So in her book, Trivium, Sister Miriam Joseph writes, "The utilitarian or servile arts enable one to be a servant of another person, of the state, of a corporation, or of a business, and to earn a living. The liberal arts, in contrast, teach one how to live. They train the faculties and bring them to perfection. They enable a person to rise above his material environment, to live an intellectual and national, and therefore a free life in gaining truth." End quote. Well, because the populace has not been taught how to think, it makes us wholly susceptible to the ubiquitous propaganda and programming we receive practically since birth. And the majority of people have no critical thinking and reasoning skills to counter all of that, which of course is the idea. In this way, the minds of the populace become stunted, resulting in compliant, unquestioning slaves who will police each other to maintain their programmed beliefs. A populace that lacks critical thinking skills is easy prey for manipulation and control because of the skillful use of words used by those who are properly educated. And this has proven to be a highly effective method of control over populations around the world. Meanwhile, the children of the wealthy and powerful few attend elite private boarding schools where they are taught indeed these arts, and that gives them a crushing advantage over the rest of the population. I recommend listening to a lecture on YouTube given by educator John Taylor Gatto titled 14 Principles of Elite Private Schools to get a taste of exactly what we've been deprived of. Then go on Gatto's YouTube channel under John Taylor Gatto and listen to every talk this man gave when he was alive, and you will learn so much. Gatto speaks to a distinct difference between schooling, which is indoctrination and dumbing down, and education. So the word education comes from the Latin educare, which means to lead out from darkness to the light of knowledge. So even though we've received the short end of the stick with regard to a true education, we can study and learn the trivium and improve our minds to create positive and lasting change for ourselves. In her essay, Dorothy Sayre describes the foundation of a medieval education, writing, quote, "Let us look at the medieval scheme of education, the syllabus of the schools. It does not matter for the moment whether it was devised for small children or for older students, or how long people were supposed to be the object and the right order of the education process. The syllabus was divided into two parts, the trivium and the quadrivium. The second part, the quadrivium, consisted of subjects and need not for the moment concern us. The interesting thing for us is the composition of the trivium, which preceded the quadrivium and was the preliminary discipline for it. It consisted of three parts, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, in that order. Now, the first thing we notice is that two, at any rate, of these subjects are not what we should call subjects at all. They're only methods of dealing with subjects. Grammar, indeed, is a subject in the sense that it does mean definitely learning a language. At that period, it meant learning Latin. But language itself is simply the medium in which thought is expressed. The whole of the trivium was, in fact, intended to teach the pupil the proper use of the tools of learning before he began to apply them to subjects at all. First, he learned a language, not just how to order a meal in a foreign language, but the structure of a language and hence of language itself, what it was, how it was put together, and how it worked. Secondly, he learned how to use language, how to define his terms and make accurate statements, how to construct an argument, and how to detect fallacies in argument, his own arguments, and other people's. Dialectic, that is to say, embraced logic and disputation. Thirdly, he learned to express himself in language, how to say what he had to say elegantly and persuasively. At this point, any tendency to express himself windily or to use his eloquence so as to make the worse appear the better reason would no doubt be restrained by his previous teaching in dialectic. If not, his teacher and his fellow pupils, trained along the same lines, would be quick to point out where he was wrong, for it was they whom he had to seek to persuade. At the end of his course, he was required to compose a thesis upon some theme set by his masters or chosen by himself, and afterwards to defend his thesis against the criticism of the faculty. By that time, he would have learned, or woe betide him, not merely to write an essay on paper, but to speak audibly and intelligibly from a platform and to use his wits quickly when heckled. End quote. So let's start with the basics of grammar. Grammar is the structure of language. And there are rules of grammar, along with terms and grammatical expressions, that once learned, provide the avenue to understanding and wisdom. To study the basics of grammar, I highly recommend reading Sister Miriam Joseph's book, The Trivium. I also recommend going to triviumeducation.com and listening to every interview you can with Jean O'Denning, who was taught the Trivium at the age of 13, and he gives a very clear overview. And he specifically recommends Sister Miriam Joseph's Trivium book for learning grammar, as he said it is the best exposition on grammar he's ever read. Also, the Wooden Book series has a wonderful book titled Trivium, the Classical Liberal Arts of Grammar, Logic, and Rhetoric, which is another great tool in learning this system. Mark Passio has given a number of excellent presentations on the Trivium and natural law, and you can find his channel on YouTube. And as well, I recommend going to Webster's 1828 Dictionary online, where you'll see grammar on the left side under topics, and you can look up the list of words whose definitions contain a reference to grammar. That's very helpful. So I will outline a few very basic concepts of grammar and encourage you to do further study on your own. The first thing to understand is that nature is reality. There are no contradictions in nature. Nature presents things as they are. What is, is. Man, on the other hand, creates abstractions. So what comes from man can be correct, can also be incorrect, or it can be deliberately false or misleading, or it can be designed to manipulate and control, which is why we need a system for evaluating what we read or hear to discern reality from unreality or fact from falsehood. Anything we receive from so-called authorities, whatever their title, anything from media, government, so-called educators, influencers, even everyday conversations, requires critical thinking. Now, in grammar, we have both special grammar and general grammar. Special grammar is concerned with the relation of words to words within specific languages like English, Latin, French, etc., where we have rules of grammar in a given language, or rules or specialized terms in subjects or professions like chemistry, biology, medicine, law, etc., which have their own special lexicons. Sister Miriam Joseph defines general grammar as, quote, concerned with the relation of words to ideas and to realities, end quote. So words themselves have meaning, but the actual truth is found in the way those words are arranged in sentences. General grammar is the raw information we take in through the five senses of taste, touch, sight, smell, and hearing. We process the information via our thoughts and analysis of the material, and we then utilize syntax, which is word order, to form the construction of sentences, where we establish an order of those thoughts to convey their meaning. Grammar asks, when is a sentence correct? Well, once the contradictions are removed and further questions are asked and resolved, we end up with a body of knowledge that produces understanding. General grammar describes reality or existence, and it includes the eight parts of speech, which are the units that make up sentences. And those are nouns, verbs, pronouns, adjectives, adverbs, prepositions, interjections, and conjunctions. These parts of speech are the foundational qualities that create syntax, which again is sentence structure. Jean O'Denning refers to grammar as the building blocks, where you are building thoughts, and that grammar refers to the way you think, the way you order your thoughts. So let's look at those eight parts of speech. So we'll start with nouns, and a noun describes a substance or subject, a person, place, animal, or thing. And this is true in every language. And there are different types of nouns. There's a proper noun, which is a name or title like Annabelle or St. John's Cathedral. Common nouns are bird, ocean, house, father, etc. Abstract nouns refer to something non-physical or conceptual that's not directly apprehended by the five senses. So examples are childhood, happiness, perception, regret, etc. Then you have collective nouns, which refer to groups or a collective of people, animals, places, or things. So examples are congregation, group, flock, team, etc. Verbs describe a state of being or action where something is active or passive, in motion or still. Sister Miriam Joseph writes, quote, "Expressing an attribute along with the notion of time is the essential function of a verb and constitutes its definition. Aristotle in the Organon defines a verb as that which, in addition to its proper meaning, carries with it the notion of time. Time is the measure of change. Since action is change and change involves time, a verb which expresses action necessarily involves time," end quote. And so examples are run, speak, swim, laugh, etc. And again, this is true in every language. Now, we need to note that adjectives, adverbs, and pronouns are attributes or qualities of nouns and verbs that express the relationship between the subject or the action and its qualities. So a pronoun is a word used in place of a noun or a name. So pronouns are you, I, he, him, she, her, we, us, and they. An adjective modifies the noun. It's an attribute that expresses the quality of the thing named. So, for example, blue, cold, dim, wide, etc. An adverb modifies the sense of a verb, adjective, or attribute. So, for example, he writes well, or the squirrel ran quickly up the tree. Next is a preposition, and a preposition introduces a descriptive or explanatory phrase. The Webster's 1828 definition of prepositions states, quote, "In grammar, a word usually put before another to express some relation or quality, action or motion to or from the thing specified. For example, from the jungle came the sound of roaring, or the cat leapt from the window to the chair, or the clerk of the court has the documents, or the dog ran down the hill, etc." So there's a very long list of common prepositions that refer to movement or placement, such as as, at, by, across, through, toward, with, up, etc., etc. And then less common prepositions are beyond, amid, concerning, onto, opposite, despite, etc. Now, an example of that is he maintained his pace despite his fatigue. With a preposition, we're constructing a more in-depth sentence using these connecting words. An interjection is a word in speaking or writing that is put between words to express emotion or passion. So often it has an exclamation mark after it. For example, hey, that's not okay. Or I almost made it, but alas, I was too late. A conjunction is a connecting word bringing together two or more simple sentences into one compound sentence. Those connecting words are and, but, or. For example, you can align yourself with truth or you can get lost in fallacy. A sentence containing all eight parts of speech would be, geez, he and Crazy Jane headed for home quickly. So gee is an interjection. He and Crazy Jane are he pronoun and conjunction, crazy adjective, Jane noun. Headed for home quickly, verb is headed. The preposition is for, and home is where they went, and quickly is the adverb. So it's kind of fun to construct those on your own and see what you come up with. Now, a word you'll hear in the study of grammar is term, and a term is simply a word or expression that determines or gives direction to an idea. So terms include the eight parts of speech, the nouns, verbs, adjectives, etc. In grammar, we create a basic sentence with both a subject and a predicate. The subject is the focus of the sentence that is performing the action, and the predicate is what's being said about that subject. The predicate exists within the subject and usually comes after the subject. We're predicating something about the subject. For example, Sharon, the subject, is very tall, predicate. Or Sharon is intelligent. Or Sharon is Allie's mother. You get the picture. We're expressing relationships in time or in space. When we get to logic, we get into propositions. A proposition is a declarative sentence that's either true or false. It's asserting a relation of terms that consists of a subject, copula, and predicate. A copula is a linking verb that joins the subject and predicate, but it's not an action verb. So here are a couple of examples. The grass is green. Good manners are appreciated. The most popular verb we use is the verb be, which has different tenses. I am, you are, he, she, it is, I was, you were, I've been, and finally, of course, to be or not to be. That's a copula. It's a state of being that is not an active verb. Other examples of copulas are seem and appear. So another statement could read, he seems content, or she appears stable. So again, this is not about action, it's about being. And there are many other copulas or linking verbs, such as smelled, tasted, etc. So a copula joins the subject and its predicate. That's a very, very elementary introduction to basic grammar. And obviously, it gets far more complex as we explore the foundations and rules of grammar. The more we avail ourselves of that study, the better will be our understanding and grasp of language, and we will be able to use words more effectively following the rules of grammar and the proper use of words. The study of logic naturally follows the study of grammar. Logic focuses on how to take the data the words comprise, analyze it, and look for and correct any contradictions. When we're seeking out contradictions in our own writing or something we've read or heard, we're into that second phase of the trivium, which is logic or dialectic. We're looking for non-contradictory information. Logic deals with thought, while grammar is focused on words and how they're combined, following the rules of language. Logic is the art of valid inference. Inference is the thought process itself. To infer is to deduce, which is to draw out truth. I have a couple of great books I recommend for the study of logic. There are a number of them out there, but I've been helped greatly in reading George Hayward Joyce's book, which was published in 1908, titled Principles of Logic, which you can download for free from archive.org. Another book I recommend is Elementary Lessons in Logic, Deductive and Inductive by W. Stanley Jevons, which was published in 1888. Gino Denning says that as you study logic and syllogisms, which are inferences, over time you program your brain to where you more easily recognize and no longer accept contradictions in arguments. So, logic is about how to think critically, and it has nothing to do with emotion or feelings or perceptions. In fact, if you're in an argument with someone and it gets emotional, end it immediately. Emotion short circuits rational thinking. Logic is the science of reasoning, and it's all about identifying contradictions so we can have an actual understanding of the material. Logic is concerned with truth, and it brings understanding by removing contradictions and inconsistencies. Logic also removes bias, perception, and feelings, again, to reveal truth. The Webster's 1828 dictionary definition of truth defines it as, quote, conformity to fact or reality, exact accordance with that which is or has been or shall be, end quote. With logic, there is no my truth, your truth, his truth, etc. There's only actual truth that is consonant with logic and reason. Truth can't have contradictory meanings at the same time. A tree is either a sapling or mature, but it can't be both at the same time. Without logic and reason, we have no universal agreed upon standards, and we end up with theories like relativism and moral relativism. Moral relativism is the theory that value judgments, especially morality, are not absolute and have no universal validity. They're only relative to the people or groups holding them. Examples of this are common in New Age circles where you'll hear people say there is no good or bad, or there's your truth and my truth, and they're both equally valid. Or you'll hear the non-duality claim that there's only one person in the room. Well, not according to the rules of logic, which of course none of us were adequately taught, if at all, in government-run schools. When we lose logic and reason, we also end up with something called polylogism. And I'm going to quote our author Leonard Peikoff, who wrote, "Polylogism is the doctrine that there is not one correct logic, one correct method of reasoning necessarily binding on all men, but that there are many logics, each valid for some men and invalid for others. The polylogist divides men into groups and holds that each group has by nature, or creates for itself by choice, its own distinctive method of inference based on its own distinctive logical laws, so that the inferences that are entirely logical for one group are entirely illogical for the others. On the polylogist view, there is no common or universal logic to serve as the objective standard and arbiter when men disagree. There is no way for members of opposing groups with opposing views to resolve their disputes. It is useless to appeal to facts or to evidence for this purpose, since the minds which engage in the process of reasoning obey different rules of thinking. In the Nazi version of polylogism, there is Aryan logic, British logic, Jewish logic, etc., and these give rise respectively to Aryan truth, British truth, Jewish truth, etc. The movement that first launched the doctrine of polylogism in a culturally influential form is Marxism. Aware of the fact that communism cannot be defended by reason, the Marxists proceeded to turn the fallacy of ad hominem into a formal philosophic doctrine, claiming that logic varies with men's economic class and that objections to communist doctrine may be dismissed as expressions of bourgeois logic. Thus, vilification of an opponent replaces analysis of his argument. Kant is the real father of polylogism, the first among the major philosophers officially to sever logic from reality. In terms of fundamentals, Nazi polylogism, like Nazi subjectivism, is simply a pluralizing and racializing of the Kantian view. Actually, polylogism is not a theory of logic. It is a denial of logic. The polylogist invests logic with the character of a mystic revelation and turns logic into its antithesis. Instead of being the means of validating objectively men's claims to knowledge, logic becomes a subjective device to be used to justify anything anyone wishes." End quote. Well, I'm sure a few of you will find some of that rather familiar these days with relativism and moral relativism and polylogism. We become verbally enslaved in a fictionalized world of words where we can no longer recognize truth from falsehood. And this is exactly where we are today. Words have been corrupted, twisted, and weaponized, and we're not allowed to question or criticize, or we're called names and terms and publicly shamed, which is part of the programming, so that any kind of intelligent inquiry and assessment based on logic and reason is wholly dismissed. So let's look at how logic works. I'm going to start with George Hayward Joyce, author of the aforementioned Principles of Logic. He writes that there are three processes in logic. The most elementary of the three is simple apprehension. This is where the mind forms a concept of something without judging, so it isn't confirming or denying anything about that concept. In his book, Logic and Mental Philosophy, Charles Coppens writes, quote, "The act of forming this mental image is called a conception, and the fruit of it, the image itself, is the concept, idea, or notion of the object. The word simple added to apprehension, emphasizes the fact that the apprehension neither affirms nor denies the existence of the object. It affirms nothing and denies nothing. It simply conceives the idea of the object. For instance, I intellectually conceive a triangle by apprehending a figure enclosed by three lines and thus having three angles. My notion or idea contains this and nothing more. It is very precise, and everyone who conceives a triangle conceives it exactly the same way. End quote. So that's a simple apprehension. Whereas a judgment requires two concepts. The first is the subject or apprehension that is expressed in the mind, and the second is the attribute expressed about that subject. Now we're in the next process in logic, which is judgment. The mind focuses on a particular subject, be it a person, place, animal, or thing. The mind then makes a judgment where it affirms or denies a particular attribute of that subject. Joyce states that every judgment requires two concepts, one in which the mind expresses the subject. So let's say the subject is a peach, the other in which it expresses the attribute of the subject. So let's say the attribute is the ripeness of the peach. We then form in the mind a preposition that the peach is ripe. Thus our judgment that took into account both the subject and the attribute. The third process is reason or inference, and Joyce defines it as, quote, the act by which from certain truths already known, the mind passes to another truth distinct from these. For example, all flowers wither in autumn. This flower is a rose. This flower will wither in autumn. Or if I argue, whatever displays the harmonious order of many parts is due to an intelligent cause. The world displays the harmonious ordering of many parts. Therefore, the world is due to an intelligent cause. End quote. Joyce explains that third line in each of those examples infers the third truth. This inference is called a syllogism. This is a formula of reasoning where you have two truths called premises, and the third truth derived from them is the conclusion. But you can only come to that conclusion when the first two premises are in agreement. Syllogisms are the strongest form of logical argument when they're formed correctly. An incorrect example of a syllogism would be Tom and Jane are raising their daughter with love and care. Tom is frustrated with rising gasoline prices. Therefore, Tom and Jane are good parents. Obviously, the first two prepositions do not align with each other to support that third inference. So that is an incorrect syllogism. Now, I did find a very funny play on syllogisms by Stephen Colbert, who jokingly wrote, God is love, love is blind. Stevie Wonder is blind, therefore Stevie Wonder is God. So obviously, that would not pass a logic test, but I thought it was fun to include. Now, we have to be on our toes with syllogisms because they can be created from invalid or manipulative premises that are perceived as true by some people and therefore make sense as a syllogism, but they are composed of ideologies or incorrect statements. They're not factual. Now, there was a study conducted in Sweden in 2022 where basic syllogisms were first taught to a group of participants who were then entered into the actual study where they were shown syllogisms that held politically ideological positions. The study showed that participants were better able to exhibit accuracy evaluating syllogisms that were in line with their ideological values. So left-leaning participants performed poorly on syllogisms with a right-leaning conclusion, and right-leaning participants performed poorly on syllogisms with a left-leaning conclusion. The study authors included an example of this using the topic of the labor market and constructing a syllogism with a left-leaning valid conclusion and a syllogism with a right-leaning valid conclusion. And I will read those so you can see for yourself how people who hold program beliefs can be swayed by their bias to reject or accept a syllogism. So the first one is left-leaning, and it states, if the labor market is not fair, then the state should intervene to equalize income. The labor market is not fair. Therefore, the state should intervene to equalize income. Well, of course, many of the right leaners who evaluated the statement did not agree with it, while the left leaners affirmed it was correct. The affirmative type of this syllogism, the syllogism with a rightist counterpart, read, if the labor market is fair, then the state should not intervene to equalize income. The labor market is fair. Therefore, the state should not intervene to equalize income. And of course, as you can imagine, a number of the left-leaners did not agree with the syllogism, while the right-leaners did. The study authors wrote in their conclusion, quote, follow-up contrast tests showed that participants who self-classified as left-leaning solved more syllogisms for which the correct answer was leftist, fewer syllogisms for which the correct answer was rightist, and about equally many neutral syllogisms compared to participants who classified as right-leaning. There was also no difference in the proportion of correctly solved training items. End quote. Now remember that in the training syllogisms, the study authors purposely didn't include any political premises. So that's very interesting. In evaluating arguments, we need to check our own biases, which cloud our ability to reason. This is why the study of logic is so important, because logic isn't emotional. It doesn't have a bias. It's about identifying truth. I will put the link to the study in the show notes for those who want to read it. Okay, so back to the three processes of the mind that logic treats. Joyce writes, quote, the science falls correspondingly into three main divisions, the logic, one, of the concept, two, of the judgment, and three, of inference, end quote. So while grammar is concerned with words and rules and terms, logic concerns itself with the name or noun, the verbal expression of the concept, and the proposition, which is the verbal expression of the judgment. Joyce writes, quote, the proposition consists of three parts. There are one, the subject, that of which the assertion is made, two, the predicate, that of which is affirmed or denied of the subject, and three, the copula, the verb is or are, which connects the subject and the predicate. The subject and the predicate are called the terms of the proposition, and the predicate is said to be predicated on the subject, end quote. So this brings me to inductive reasoning, which is where we utilize our five senses of touch, sight, hearing, smell, and taste to see or perceive the world around us. This is generalized, and Stanley Jevons writes, quote, in induction, on the contrary, we proceed from less general or even from individual facts to more general propositions, truths, or as we shall often call them, laws of nature. When it is known that Mercury moves in an elliptic orbit around the sun, as also Venus, the Earth, Mars, Jupiter, etc., we're able to arrive at the simple and general truth that all the planets move in elliptic orbits around the sun. End quote. This is an example of an inductive process of reasoning. He goes on to say of inductive reasoning that, quote, it is engaged in detecting the general laws or uniformities, the relations of cause and effect, or in short, all the general truths that may be asserted concerning the numberless and very diverse events that take place in the natural world around us. The greater part, if not, as some philosophers think, the whole of our knowledge is ultimately due to inductive reasoning. The mind, it is plausibly said, is not furnished with knowledge in the form of general propositions ready-made and stamped upon it, but is endowed with powers of observation, comparison, and reasoning, which are adequate, when well-educated and exercised, to procure knowledge of the world without us and the world within the human mind. Even when we argue synthetically and deductively from simple ideas and truths, which seem to be ready in the mind, as in the case of the science of geometry, it may be that we have gathered these simple ideas and truths from previous observation or induction of an almost unconscious kind. If the truth be as stated, induction will be the mode by which all the materials of knowledge are brought to the mind and analyzed. Deduction will then be the almost equally important process by which the knowledge thus acquired is utilized, end quote. So inductive reasoning is like synthesis, where you're gathering different ideas into a cohesive whole. It's the big picture. For instance, we can think of a genus, which is the greater whole or group or general category. So for instance, the genus could be Canis. Then through deduction, we take that apart and analyze it in order to understand it. And in this case, we come up with various species of dogs contained within the genus of Canis, which gives us a greater understanding of that general category. And our analysis reveals much more information that forms a body of knowledge. This is why Webster's 1828 dictionary says of deductive, quote, "All knowledge is deductive." So with deductive reasoning, you're analyzing and taking something apart to get an understanding and to get to the deeper truth of the matter. This is a naturally occurring process, as Jevons stated. Our mind observes, compares, and reasons, and it is naturally inductive and deductive. The right brain is all about the big picture, which is inductive, and our logical left brain is the deductive side that takes apart the big picture generalities and gets into the very fiber of it so it can comprehend the deeper truth of that concept. At the end of the day, we want to be able to reason intelligently and correctly. The most basic rule of thumb when we're forming an argument is that it has to be logically well formed. We want to put forth clear premises that produce a logical conclusion, and we want those premises to contain information that is relevant and unambiguous so that the conclusion is valid. With arguments, the most important consideration is validity, especially when it comes to deducing something, and we need to be able to recognize whether that argument is strong or weak. So let's explore logical fallacies. Logical fallacies are common flaws in reasoning. The more we familiarize ourselves with them, the easier it's going to be to identify them in someone's argument or claim. And when that happens, the mind starts to experience liberation because we are now able to discern between truth and falsehood. And that is no small feat in today's world. I actually think this knowledge is the ultimate in truly empowering yourself. So Sister Miriam Joseph writes that a fallacy is, quote, "a violation of a logical principle disguised under an appearance of validity. It is an error in process. To discover a fallacy is to discover the reason why the mind was deceived into regarding the error as truth. To classify fallacies is to attempt to find common ground for such deception. But a given argument may be fallacious for more reasons than one, and hence it may exemplify more than one fallacy. Consequently, a classification of fallacies is neither exhaustive nor mutually exclusive," end quote. All right, let's start with argumentum ad verecundium, which is appeal to authority. This is one of the most commonly used logical fallacies today. An appeal to authority is the substitution of an authority to prove the validity of the argument rather than producing actual evidence of one's claim. Note that just because someone is considered an authority on something doesn't mean they're always correct, nor does it mean that they always tell the truth. People are fallible and they make mistakes, and certain people can be corrupt and abuse their authority for profit or to promote an agenda, ideology, etc. So an example of appeal to authority is the use of celebrities of every kind as spokespeople for products or ideologies. And we have organizations such as the CDC and the WHO and popular media organizations, government institutions such as universities that are regarded by the general public as authorities in particular areas. People are so identified with the touted authority of those entities that they blindly believe and unquestioningly obey what those entities claim with zero critical reflection. An example of an appeal to authority is, well, the CDC said masks prevent the spread, so we have to wear them. Or, he's a doctor, he knows what he's talking about. Or, I trust the science. In those examples, a perceived authority has been substituted for actual evidence of the claims. There's a great quote related to this fallacy by the English poet Gerald Massey, who said, quote, "They must find it difficult, those who've taken authority over truth rather than truth over authority." The next fallacy is argumentum ad hominem. This literally means argument to the man and not the argument. This is when the person on the other side of the argument, rather than producing a cogent counterpoint, proceeds to attack your character, conduct, and/or circumstances, which is totally irrelevant to the argument, but they're trying to establish that you are somehow unworthy and your argument has no merit. An example of that is, you're not a doctor, you have no idea what you're talking about. Or, you're a conspiracy theorist, so there goes your argument. A similar fallacy to ad hominem is a tu quoque, which is Latin for you too. This is when someone is being criticized or accused of something they did, and rather than taking accountability, their reply is to accuse the other of the same thing. So for instance, well, you did that when you were young, or you did the same thing just last week. So instead of answering to the issue, they deflect the issue back to the accuser, thereby shifting the focus off themselves and essentially implying that if both of them are guilty of having done the same thing, then neither of them is guilty of any wrongdoing. So this fallacy does not address the validity of the accusation or critique with a proper response. This is all about deflection, which is not a valid defense or argument. Next, we have argumentum ad baculum, which is an appeal to force. This is where, instead of presenting facts in their argument, one instead resorts to intimidation or threat to get the other to accept their claim. We saw this during the last few years where people were told by their employers, the shot is a mandatory protective measure, and if you do not agree and comply, you will be fired. That is a classic argumentum ad baculum. Another example is, you better listen if you're going, or you're going to find yourself facing an angry mob. It can also be an insinuated threat, i.e., if you don't give my daughter that position, things could get very uncomfortable for you moving forward. Argumentum ad baculum is the appeal to a cudgel, bat, or stick that is wielded threateningly. Next is argumentum in terrorem, which is appeal to fear. So while argumentum ad baculum uses force to get others to agree, appeal to fear is used to frighten others with scare tactics, often with dire warnings that something terrible will happen if they don't agree. But there's never actual evidence presented to back that claim. This is a manipulation that leverages fear in people and instills dread and anxiety to where they will acquiesce to the claim rather than deliberate with reason and temperance. An appeal to fear usually begins with describing the danger and ends with how to avoid the danger, which is very calming to the reader. So the first part of this tactic instills the fear, and the second part offers the solution. A recent example of this comes from the New York Times that stated, quote, "The virus is spreading, but new vaccines coming this fall could offer better protection," end quote. This is known as escalation and de-escalation of fear, and both are needed for the message to work. People do not think clearly when they're afraid, and rational discourse is next to impossible. Appeal to fear is an old trick in government propaganda where covert psychological strategies are used to cripple the public with fear. And this is usually accompanied by the inducement for the public to sacrifice their individual liberties for the common good. This is why Ben Franklin said over 200 years ago, quote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety," end quote. Appeal to fear is used in advertising as well, of course, for home security and medicine, etc. And the media uses it literally, liberally, especially in their headlines. And a recent example of appeal to fear was the slogan from these past few years, stay home, save lives. Another example is, quote, if you speak on that subject, you'll lose your tenure. So just play the game, end quote. So appeal to fear is highly, highly manipulative. The next one is argumentum ad populum. This is appeal to popularity. So this refers to a claim that is said to be true because that's what everyone believes or does. This is also known as the bandwagon fallacy. And there is an old saying that goes, 10 million Frenchmen can't be wrong, but of course they can. So this is used in advertising all the time. For instance, 9 out of 10 doctors recommend this. Or someone says, you have to read this book, it's a bestseller. So they're appealing to popularity. Just because the majority of people in a society think something is so, doesn't mean it actually is. You could have a number of people in society falling in line with a particular ideology or a trend. It still doesn't make it valid. There is a superb book on the subject that I've mentioned before titled Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles McKay, written in 1840. You can download it for free. And it is a fascinating book that describes what happens when people get swept up in popular delusions. All right, the next one is argumentum ad ignorantium. This is the use of an argument that sounds convincing to others because they're ignorant of the weakness of the argument and of the facts that stand against it. This is when someone insists that something is true because it hasn't been proven false, or they insist that something is false because it hasn't been proven true. The ad ignorantium argument is based solely on the fact that no proof is offered for the claim. So an example would be the claim that aliens exist because it's never been proven that they don't exist, or aliens don't exist because it's never been proven that they do exist. Well, you can't prove a negative. You can only prove a positive. Thus, the maxim of law that says the burden is on he who affirms, not he who denies. This is the onus of proof principle. What is not can't be proven. This is why in court, the burden is on the prosecutor to prove the defendant committed the crime. Next is appeal to emotion. This is a fallacy that is commonly used by advertisers and government agencies, politicians, etc., where they attempt to convince you of something by evoking emotion in you rather than providing evidence for their claim. This is also used in calls to action, to vote, donate, purchase something, adopt a certain way of thinking, or turn you against someone or for someone or something, all done through getting people emotionally worked up with excitement, hope, anger, fear, grief, shock, guilt, shame, etc. For example, in a print ad for Viagra, which is a medication for erectile dysfunction, the image is always of a gorgeous woman lying down and looking directly into the camera with sultry eyes. The message being, of course, that if he takes Viagra, he'll be able to have sex with this gorgeous woman. Another example is we are shown a photograph, real or an image, real or staged, you never know, especially these days, of an image that evokes emotion in order to steer us in whatever direction those posting it wish for us to go. So, you know, that goes from everything from puppies at shelters to, you know, someone who's been the victim of something. It really evokes, it's very effective for evoking emotion. Now, in commercials for alcohol, they always use good-looking people having a great time together with drink in hand. So again, this is appealing to your emotions. To you want to be out and accepted and have fun and liked, and sure, drink this alcohol, and all of that will happen for you. Another example is a politician is asked how her or his policies will combat inflation. And rather than answering the actual question, the politician waxes poetic about economic growth in the future and how that will lead to more jobs and growth. How many times have we heard a version of that from a politician? The next is argumentum ad misericordiam, which is appeal to pity. Unlike appeal to emotion, this fallacy replaces reason with a specific plea for sympathy or compassion. The person making the claim is attempting to get you to feel sorry for them rather than provide you with a valid argument. This is used to get donations or prevent someone from being disciplined or punished. And of course, it's used in court by criminal lawyers to get a favorable verdict. And it's used in the media constantly these days to excuse bad or horrible behavior rather than address the actual issues. Examples are, we all know this one, please don't fail my paper. My boyfriend broke up with me, or my girlfriend broke up with me, or whatever the excuse, right? Or not answering the question, but and speaking to the issue, but instead crying or telling a sob story. This is a means of manipulation to avoid addressing the actual issue. I'm at the end of the first hour, so I will continue discussing more fallacies in the second hour, where I'll also explore rhetoric, along with a list of tried and true rhetorical techniques that are designed to help you get your message across in a way that is clever, memorable, imaginative, and effective. Please join me at themushroomsapprentice.com and subscribe for a small monthly fee to access the second hour of these episodes. Thank you so much.